Brilliant. Over to you, Max.
Thank you, Christoph. Okay, well, I'm going to try and really give you a whistle-stop tour in the next 20 minutes of some of the multiple lines of evidence that come together to give us a real solid confidence in the trustworthiness of the scriptures. And so the reading from Luke's Gospel, that introduction is actually, historians who have studied this would look at this and say that those words where Luke says, "I've set out to give you an orderly account," and so on, these are actually very similar to the kind of prefaces that historians in the ancient world would put at the beginning of their works to kind of certify, "I've really looked carefully into this, I've traveled around to the places and I've talked to the eyewitnesses." And as we're going to see, we have excellent reasons to think that that really is the case. And so you'll see there's this diagram with these concentric circles on the front page of the booklet. So this is just to give you a sense, really, of how we can think about the ways that, these different types of evidence break down. So we can broadly talk about external evidence for the reliability of the New Testament. So that's to say, we can think about whether there are sources outside of the New Testament, so archaeology or sources written by non-Christians, which broadly corroborate the New Testament. And we can think about three different types of corroboration. So we can think about ways in which the world depicted by the New Testament is corroborated. So that's to say, the places, are these real places? The sort of religious atmosphere of the time and place, is it true to how it was? And the customs. We can also think about whether the characters are real and whether there's evidence for that. And then whether there's non-Christian written sources from the ancient world that even attest the core events of the New Testament. And then we can think about internal evidence, which is to say, are there hallmarks within the New Testament itself of truthfulness? Okay, so I'm really just going to give you a little flavor of each of these, and there's so much more that could be said. But hopefully this will at least give you a taste for each of the different types of evidence that we can think about. So on the second page of your booklet, here are a couple of interesting examples. So you know in John 5, it talks about how there's a pool near the Sheep Gate in Jerusalem called Bethesda that has these five porticos, and Jesus healed a blind man there. Well, scholars in the early 20th century used to be quite skeptical about this, and many would say that John had just made this up because it was symbolic. But then it was excavated in 1956, and the details of it actually match really well with the archaeology. So it does indeed have five porticos, five archways, which was actually unusual because most of these pools had just four arches. It is indeed near the Sheep Gate in Jerusalem. And other details besides. And so, and this is just one example. There are about 20 different places in John's Gospel that are mentioned and described, and most of them have now been unearthed by archaeologists, and they fit to a very high degree of accuracy with what we find. So just giving this real sense, the person who wrote John's Gospel really was familiar with these places. He must be relying on the testimony of an eyewitness. Capernaum, as you may know, is a town that's mentioned a lot in the Gospels. It's on the northwestern shore of the Sea of Galilee, and it seems to be where Jesus kind of based his ministry in Galilee. And the archaeological excavations there have also corroborated what the Gospels say about this town. So it seems to have a customs house where there would be tax collectors working, which fits with the fact that Jesus calls Levi, or Matthew, a tax collector in the town of Capernaum. There seems to have been a Roman garrison where Roman centurions would be stationed. And Jesus, in Luke and Matthew's Gospels, heals the servant of a centurion in Capernaum. There's evidence of a fish trade, which fits with the fact that some of Jesus' disciples were fishermen and that they were based in Capernaum. And archaeologists have even found what they're pretty confident is Peter's house. Now, Luke not only wrote the Gospel of Luke, but also the Acts of the Apostles. And Acts affords lots of opportunity for kind of checking against external sources because it covers quite a wide time period of about 30 years, and it spans geographically a lot of the Eastern Mediterranean. And there's this book by a classicist called Colin Hemer, where basically he goes through the book of Acts, the last 16 chapters, almost verse by verse, and just shows how many of the details that Luke gives of things like, you know, the details of local trades and customs, who was in power at what time and when and so on. And consistently, Luke just keeps getting these right. And we can check this now from things like inscriptions and other kinds of archaeological discoveries. Just to give you one specific kind of example, lots of the provinces in the Roman Empire had different titles for the governing official there. So sometimes it would be governor, but sometimes it would be proconsul or ruler or first man. And these titles really varied a lot between the different provinces, and they changed as well from decade to decade. And of course, you didn't have Wikipedia or Google then, and you couldn't just, there's no way that you could correctly guess these titles. And Luke consistently gets these titles right whenever he mentions a ruling figure in one of these places. And so we just kind of build up this sense of Luke as a historian really must have traveled to these places. And in fact, we have very good reason to think that he accompanied the Apostle Paul on Paul's last journey to Jerusalem, which is where Luke presumably would have had lots of opportunity to speak to eyewitnesses, which is what he tells us he did in his preface, which was just read out to us. But it's not just the places, it's also the kind of political and religious vibe of the day that the New Testament gets so right. So there's this story in Mark's Gospel where these Sadducees come to Jesus, and they say that these Sadducees don't believe there will be a final resurrection of the dead. And they're trying to sort of test Jesus on this issue, which is very important to them. And then Jesus, interestingly, responds to them not by appealing to, say, the book of Daniel or Ezekiel with the Valley of Dry Bones, which very clearly talk about that there will be a final resurrection of the dead on Judgment Day. But rather, Jesus appeals to this passage, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, from Exodus, which is interesting because you would think, why doesn't Jesus pick a more relevant scripture to refute these Sadducees? But actually, what we know from other sources is that the Sadducees, indeed, they didn't believe in a final resurrection, but also they did not accept the authority of the prophets like Daniel and Ezekiel. They only accepted the authority of the first five books, the books of Moses. Mark doesn't tell us this, but it's just completely implied and just goes to show how accurate his information is about what was going on at the time, that these Sadducees indeed didn't accept a resurrection or the authority of these later books of the Old Testament. But none of that is stated like Mark's trying to show off how much he knows. And this is the kind of thing historians really value, is when a source just completely in passing gets right these details about the historical context. So that gives you a sense of the accuracy of the Gospels and Acts with respect to the places, the customs, the political atmosphere, and so on. Let's consider now evidence from outside the New Testament for the characters in the New Testament. So Josephus, he was a Jewish historian and aristocrat writing towards the end of the first century. And in this work called The Antiquities of the Jewish People, Josephus mentions a number of the main characters of the New Testament, including Jesus, and we'll come back to that in a moment, but also John the Baptist. He talks about the Herod family, Caiaphas, the high priest, Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, and James, the brother of Jesus. And actually, there are a number of other sources outside the New Testament which talk about several of these characters besides. Now, as for the minor characters, there are about 100 Jewish named individuals across the Gospels and Acts. And there's been a relatively recent discovery, which is really powerful and quite encouraging as to the reliability of the New Testament. And basically, archaeologists who have studied ancient Israel have basically built up a database of about 3,000 names of people who lived in Israel in the time of Jesus. And they've done this by looking at grave inscriptions, legal documents, and so on. So they know the names of about 3,000 individual people who lived around the time of Jesus. And what they can do from this is start to say, what percentage, let's say, of the men were called Joseph? What percentage were called Jesus? What percentage of the women were called Mary? And then we can take that and compare it with the New Testament. What percentage of the men in the New Testament are called, these various names? And what we find, and this table sort of gives you a sense of that, is that there's an incredible striking match between these percentages. So that the percentage of the men who are called Simon in this archaeology database is about 9.3%. In the Gospels and Acts, it's 10%. It's the most common name in both. And you can go down that list and just see how close these matches are. Not perfect, but you wouldn't expect that. But what this shows is that these names of characters in the Gospels and Acts could not have been invented in a way that would match the real frequencies of these names in the population around the time of Jesus. So you just would never be able to invent this and get those frequencies right without access to the kind of survey data that we have. And so these characters, even the minor ones, we have every reason to think that they were real people. Okay, now turning to the question of whether there are sources outside the New Testament that attest even the events, the core events of the story of Jesus. We do indeed have several such sources. So Josephus we've encountered already. Josephus has this short passage about Jesus. Now, scholars think that it has been touched up a little bit by a later Christian scribe copying it, but that we can basically weed out the bits that were added in, and I've put those in square brackets. And we can basically be confident that we can get back to the text that Josephus himself wrote about Jesus, and this is what it is. Now, there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, for he was a doer of surprising works, a teacher of such men as receive the truth with pleasure. He drew over to himself both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for they reported that he appeared alive to them. And the tribe of Christians, so named from him, are not extinct at this day. And so Josephus, as an outsider, gives us this relatively neutral portrait of Jesus, but one that basically fits with the outline of Jesus' story that we get in the New Testament. And then we've got this Roman historian, Tacitus, writing in the early second century. And basically he's writing about the persecutions of Christians that happened in the middle of the first century in Rome, and he's explaining where this group, the Christians, came from. And I'll just read this one bit. He says, Christus, from whom the name Christian had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. And a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome. And he goes on to talk about what happened to the Christians in Rome. And then we've got this letter from Pliny the Younger, who was a Roman governor of the province of Bithynia, which is in modern-day Turkey. Writing in the early second century, Pliny was writing to the emperor Trajan because the Christianity was growing very fast in his province, and he basically was worried about this and wanted to know what he should do with these Christians when if they were arrested and brought before him. And he's in writing to the Emperor Trajan, he writes this, the Christians were in the habit of meeting on a certain fixed day before it was light, when they sang in alternate verses a hymn to Christ as to a God. And he goes on and says some other things. But that's very interesting because that's a non-Christian source outside the New Testament attesting that the early Christians worshipped Jesus as God. So taken together, the earliest non-Christian sources. So imagine for a moment that we actually didn't have the New Testament at all. All we had is just these non-Christian sources that I've talked about. Nonetheless, we could still get the outline of the story of Jesus and the early church. So we would know just from these three non-Christian sources that Jesus was known as a moral teacher and wise man, that his followers believed him to be the Christ, the Jewish Messiah, that he had this reputation for surprising deeds, as Josephus puts it, a reference to Jesus' reputation as a miracle worker. We'd know that he was condemned to death by crucifixion under the authority of Pontius Pilate, and that the Jewish chief priests were somehow involved too, and that the movement he founded stopped temporarily once he was executed, but that it quickly started again, and his followers were claiming that he appeared to them alive. We'd also know that he had a brother called James, and that the Christian movement grew rapidly in Judea, where it started and soon spread as far as Rome. And we'd know about the persecution of Christians in the early decades. And we'd also know that they would meet together on a fixed day to worship Jesus together. So that's pretty striking, actually, when you think about it, that in terms of a sort of a broad contour map of the story of Jesus, you basically get that from just these non-Christian sources. Now, turning to the internal evidence of the New Testament, a key point, even though the New Testament is bound together under one cover in modern Bibles, historians recognize that the New Testament is not one single source. It's actually multiple independent sources. So we have Paul's letters, probably the earliest documents in the New Testament. We have the letter of James, the brother of Jesus. In terms of the Gospels, Mark was probably the earliest to be written. Matthew and Luke seem to have used Mark as a source, but Matthew and Luke also have this separate source that they have in common with each other that's not from Mark, which many scholars think was a document that had lots of Jesus' sayings, which is known as Q. Then Matthew and Luke each had material that was unique to them. And then John's Gospel is typically thought to be independent from the other Gospels. So let's just have the key point here is that when you have multiple sources all attesting the same core story, that gives historians a very high degree of confidence. And so something that's worth bearing in mind is that for ancient history, we often, for some key events, we may only have two or three sources, separate sources attesting these events. When we have, in the case of Jesus, six or seven independent sources all attesting the same kind of core gist of the story, well, that gives a very high degree of confidence that this story is a real story. So let's just quickly look at one of these sources. As I said, Paul's letters are probably the earliest documents in the New Testament, written just 20 years or so after Jesus' crucifixion, and which by the standards of ancient history is very close to the events. When you bear in mind that, the earliest documents we have about the Emperor Tiberius, which really give any details about his life, are 77 years afterwards. And yet it's considered we can know lots of things about Tiberius. So that just gives you a sense. 20 years is really a very short time gap for ancient history. Now, the other thing is that Paul undoubtedly knew several of the key eyewitnesses of Jesus' ministry. So, because he talks about meeting Peter on several occasions, he talks about meeting with Jesus' brothers, including James. And so Paul was in a really great position to know the facts. And here are some of the things that, again, imagine we didn't have the Gospels. Imagine we just had Paul's letters. We could really know a surprising amount of stuff about Jesus just from Paul's letters. So we would know that Jesus was Jewish because he was born of a Jewish woman. We'd know that Jesus had several brothers. One of them was called James. we would know about this special inner circle of disciples, the 12, and that we would know that Peter seemed to have some kind of prominent role within that. We'd also know that Jesus' ministry focused mainly on Israel rather than the Gentiles. We would know that he summarized his ethical teaching as love for one another. We would also know that Jesus declared that he was going to return in glory, and that his return would be at an unexpected hour, like a thief coming in the night. That quite striking parable Jesus tells about his return being like a thief in the night. Well, Paul also seems to know about that in 1 Thessalonians 5. We'd know that his followers thought he was the Jewish Messiah, and we'd also know about the Last Supper from Paul's letter to the Corinthians, where he talks about how Jesus spoke these words over the bread and wine, saying that, you know, the bread was his body and the wine was his blood. And we'd know that he was betrayed by someone. We'd also know from Paul's letters that Jesus was crucified by the Romans, but also that the Jewish authorities were involved somehow too. We'd also know that Jesus was buried in a tomb rather than just being left out to rot. And we'd know that that his earliest followers believed that the risen Jesus appeared to them on multiple occasions. If you remember, Paul gives us that list of the people to whom Jesus appeared in 1 Corinthians 15. So we'd really know a lot about Jesus, in outline at least, just from Paul's letters. Now, there's another kind of test that historians will apply to documents, and it's this. If a source gives details that would have seemed kind of awkward or embarrassing, even from the point of view of the author, that gives us reason to think that the author is not inventing this stuff. So there's many instances of this in the Gospels. So, for instance, the male disciples are often very kind of slow on the uptake. The male disciples abandon Jesus when he's arrested, and the only disciples who stay with Jesus are the women. Then there's Peter's denial of Jesus. Peter, you know, kind of being a key leader in the early church, that would have been very embarrassing to admit that Peter, you know, denied Jesus. Then there's the crucifixion itself. It's hard for us to just imagine how appallingly shameful crucifixion was, and the idea of a crucified Messiah, just completely scandalous for a first century Jew. And then there's the fact that women play a really prominent role as the witnesses to the resurrection. Again, we might not really think anything of this, but when you consider how women's testimony was held in such low regard in the first century, if you were inventing stories about the empty tomb being discovered and you wanted to persuade as many people as possible in a first century Mediterranean world, you would have had Peter be the first to the tomb, not Mary Magdalene. And I've given you some quotes just to give you a sense of the sorts of attitudes people in the ancient world would have had towards women's testimony. Finally, let me just very briefly mention something called undesigned coincidences. So this is actually something crime scene investigators look for when you have separate testimonies to an event, and they kind of give different details, but that actually sort of interlock together and dovetail to give a almost three-dimensional picture of what's going on. That is a very good sign of authentic eyewitness testimony. So let me just give you one example. In John's Gospel, the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus picks on Philip for some reason. And he says, "Philip, where shall we get bread for all these people?" Now, Philip is not the most prominent disciple, and we're not. So it's a little bit odd that he would pick Philip, and John doesn't tell us why he did that. In a completely separate part of John's Gospel, we're told that Philip was from this town called Bethsaida, which is actually on the northeastern shore of the Sea of Galilee. Now, we turn to Luke's Gospel. Luke says nothing about this stuff to do with Philip being the one who was singled out or where Philip was from. But Luke gives us a detail that's not in the other Gospels, namely that the feeding of the 5,000 took place near the town of Bethsaida. So now it's almost like you've got different pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that fit together. but it's clearly completely unplanned. There's no hint that that Luke and John conspired to create this. So we wonder, why does Jesus pick on Philip, this not particularly prominent disciple? Well, the feeding of the 5,000 is taking place near Bethsaida, and Philip is from Bethsaida. So it now kind of makes sense. Jesus picks on Philip because he's from round here, and he's sort of saying, Philip, you're from here. Where are the local shops? Where should we go to get bread? And there's lots more examples of undesigned coincidences in the Gospels. So really, I've kind of rushed through that, and there's so much more to say. But I hope to have just given you a flavor of some of the many lines of evidence which come together to give us confidence that this story of Jesus in the early church is a real historical story. And the New Testament is a faithful record of what happened that's rooted in eyewitness testimony. And so, as I said to Christoph earlier, for me, when I was considering Christianity at the age of 19, this was this kind of discovery for me that there actually is real solid historical evidence for the story of Jesus, the reliability of the New Testament. This was very significant for me. To move from thinking that this is sort of, you know, fables and fairy tales to actually this is a real historical story that's rooted in time and space and reflects all sorts of accurate details. That was very significant for me in being able to really take Jesus seriously and the claims that he makes about himself. So we've got these feedback cards. You should be able to find them in front of you. So if you have a question, we'd love for you to write that question down, and hopefully you'll get an opportunity I'll hopefully be able to speak to some of these questions. So if you have a question, then feel free to write that down. If you feel like, you know, you've been thinking about this story of Jesus and you feel like you've never really quite taken that step of asking Jesus into your life and committing to follow him, we'd love it if you feel comfortable just ticking count me in, and you'll be able to have someone just take that conversation further with you. And if that is the position you find yourself in, I'm just going to pray a short prayer now. And if you feel that you want to, just feel free to kind of echo that prayer in your heart. So, dear Father, we just thank you so much that you have sent your Son into the world, your only begotten Son, because you love us so much. And thank you that you have left us behind such a rich historical record of the life, death, and resurrection of your Son, Jesus. Lord, I'm sorry for the ways in which I've lived my life in ways that have hurt you and disappointed you. Please come into my life and send your Spirit to live within me. Amen.